So, as I mentioned earlier, today is called Vesak, the birth of the Buddha. And so traditionally, Buddhist countries, Buddhists, it's a significant day, just like for Christians, the birth of Christ is a significant day, the birth of the Buddha is significant to those on the path. You know, for a number of reasons. Obviously, if one is a Buddhist, he is the founder. I mean, Buddhism is based on him and his experience and his enlightenment and his teachings 2,600 years ago. So he is our founder. He is our we wouldn't be here, so to speak, if it wasn't for him. Of course, for 2,600 years, there have been endless teachers, masters who have maintained the integrity of the Buddhist teachings, and most importantly, have maintained the integrity of the enlightened experience, which is what the Buddha, that's what made the Buddha a Buddha. We'll talk a little bit about his non-Buddha life as a younger person. So we celebrate his birth both as an historical experience, but we also celebrate it because he opened the path to awakening. He pointed out directly that all of us have this awakened nature. It doesn't matter what our conditioning is, what's happened up to now, what our status, that has nothing to do with our unconditioned mind. And so he pointed it out through his own enlightenment. Plus, he developed a path during the course of his life to show us the way of how to come to that realization and transformation ourselves, which, of course, is the Buddhist path. So we acknowledge the significance of what had happened. And it is important to understand that we are talking about an historical person. You know, some people, think it's a kind of a myth, these creation myths, but it's not the case at all. I mean, the Buddha was an historical man. His life is well documented. He left a very intact community and a monastic institution that basically recorded things, as well as from those of us in the West who like historical references. Several generations after his passing, there was a great Buddhist king named Ashoka. And what Ashoka did is he went around and erected pillars at all the places that were significant in the Buddha's life when those places were still known. And the interesting thing was when the British came to India and took over, I mean, Buddhism was all throughout Asia, but it really was no longer really present, hardly at all, in India. And so there was all this, history in all these other Buddhist countries about the Buddha and where he was born and where he became enlightened and where he died and all that. And they were named, but many of the names, of course, over the course of 2,600 years had changed from the original names. There were these Ashoka pillars. And so the British Archaeological Society, and I forget his name, really undertook archaeological digs at these supposed sites that no longer were seen. And they found all the pillars these Ashokan pillars, where he had erected these stone pillars and had written on them exactly the Buddha here did this and the Buddha here did that and other kinds of things. So we know through archaeology that the somewhat embroidered accounts of Siddhartha's life and the Buddha's life were all based on historical facts. And we like to know those facts, don't we? We're Americans. So a little about You know, we can imagine, since it was 2,600 years ago, since it was, you know, there was no country called Nepal or India in those days. That area was made up of many smaller nation states ruled by kings, and it was a feudalistic society. So, you know, lots of different kingdoms, small and large and all that. So the Buddha was born in an area that was now considered southern Nepal. Or very close to northern India. And in the up to many centuries, there was a dispute where Lumbini, where the Buddha was born, was it born in India or was it born in northern India? And they had their own places, the same way with Kapilavastu and other places of the Buddha's life. But when they found the Ashokan pillars, it was decided. And so Lumbini, where the Buddha was born, is in southern Nepal. So 2,600 years ago, a feudalistic society, agrarian society, very different than our today. And so we can like, say, oh, that was a long time ago. Things were very different then. Things were not different. The Buddha was looking at the same exact things that we are looking at, both in terms of the human condition as well as the social condition. It's very important that we understand that. Because we have a kind of a hubris that somehow what's going on today is extra special or different. But the Buddha saw what was unfortunately going on with human beings. So in a certain sense, the human condition was the same. People were born and people died. And in between, they got sick and they aged. This was a fundamental unfolding of the human condition that the Buddha very clearly observed was going on. And that impermanence of life, he saw it caused many people lots of suffering, lots of grief. He also saw that human beings were driven to seek pleasure and to avoid pain, to seek fame and notoriety and to be noticed and to be devastated by not being noticed, being ignored, that human beings sought gain in life and didn't like to lose. So he observed the human condition very clearly, which is the same condition, just that, you know, it manifests in a different way that we're dealing with today. As well as societally, he dealt with all the same issues we dealt with. There was lots of war, you know, among the various kingdoms. They go around slaughtering each other over the hubris of you know, the despots, the kings, the rulers, you know, over territory and land, right? There was economic inequality, big differences. There was significant pervasive racism. It's called casteism, but they have lots of parallels. There were those people of the upper caste and those people of the lower caste. And the lower caste people were kept separate and unequal from the people of the upper caste. Very clearly defined, rigid system. So rigid, even to today in various sectors, that if a person of a higher caste would come in contact with a person of a lower caste, you know, even touch them, remember they're called untouchables, they would be considered polluted. And you'd have to go through a whole ritual to undo the pollution of even coming in touch. So, you know, so there was casteism, racism, there was violence, there was sexism, women were the under the care and control of their fathers until they married, at which point they would be under the control of their husbands and their husband's family, right? And so there was lots of inequality, economic inequality, and race and gender inequality. Yeah, sound familiar? Yeah. So this is the world the Buddha was born into, both, as I say, in terms of the human condition as well as the in terms of the social condition. So once upon a time, a long time ago, there was a principality in northern India, southern Nepal, and there was a ruler, and there was his wife, and she became pregnant, Queen Maya. Of course, just like in other traditions, her pregnancy was miraculous. But we don't need to go into that. But anyhow, she became pregnant and gave birth to a boy, and there's lots of miraculous things associated with that, including after 7 days walking seven steps when he was, or just after he was born, he walked seven steps and sort of let everyone know his true state. But the interesting thing was, as was typical then, and I believe probably is typical now in that part of the world, when a child is born, the parents have an astrologer develop a chart for them, and the astrologer who drew up the chart for Siddhartha, basically said the way everything's lining up for him is he's going to be great. He's a very special being. He'll either be a great leader, a great king, a great ruler of people, or he will renounce all that and become a great spiritual light. Right? Now, his parents, being of the warrior caste, the ruling, you know, the Kshatriya class, of course, you know, wanted their son to, you know, take over the kingdom, so to speak, you know, like take over the family business. So they definitely did not want him to go that path of renunciation. So basically, they very consciously, very deliberately tried to create a process for him in which he did not come into contact with anything which would any way find disturbing. Okay, they wanted him just totally enjoy the life of the palace and all the good things in the palace, and so he would just very seamlessly eventually take over the kingdom. And so from what we know is that that is the way he grew up, that is the way he was nurtured. He you know, he grew up, we might say for his time, he grew up in privilege, right? And he had a good life. he enjoyed all the things that that a young man of his privileged life would enjoy, right? He liked to hunt, he liked sports, he was athletic. You know, he was educated in terms of the teachings of that time. And so it was a very seamless life. We were told he was very happy. And in all his growing up, through his teenage years, in a certain sense, he was just very, you know, successful. A student, so to speak, four-letter A student, you know. He had one experience, which was very important. He was somewhere in his middle teens, and it was the planting festival, you know, where they would go out into the fields and turn over the earth for a new planting season. And obviously the royal family was part of that process, blessing the land and all that for the crop. And he was, it was very hot. And he was feeling very kind of overwhelmed by the heat, so he went to sit down under a tree nearby, kind of watching the field. And as he was watching the oxen pulling the plow and driving through the fields, turning over the earth, he could see little rodents and animals kind of running for their life or being killed, being trampled on or being hurt by the plow, and insects and birds, and so birds coming down and eating the insects. And somehow that touched him. He kind of went, wow, you know, sort of like, what's going on here? And that experience kind of made him kind of go into himself in a way that he had never come before. It was like the external experience was kind of negative. And somehow, just intuitively, he just went inside his own mind, maybe his own body breath, and he felt this deep state of calmness, this deep state of oneness, you know, just touched that place within himself momentarily that had nothing to do with, you know, what he had been experiencing. But then, of course, he went back to his normal life and continued on as people of his class casted and married and had a son, Rahulah. And everything was hunky-dory, right? His parents had succeeded in creating this ideal life for him, very protective. Okay. And he had this kind of curiosity about what was going on outside the walls of the palace, you see. He had this very isolated life. It's like, and again, I think that's not, could not be unknown to many of us. You know, we sort of live in our bubble. And we do our best within our bubble to control our bubble. So everything kind of works for us, right? That's a lot of way we spend our life, making everything right, controlling everything, you know, not having all the things that could disturb it. So, you know, it may sound a little extraordinary what his parents were up to, but I don't think it's that extraordinary, right? A lot of parents try to protect and create a bubble around their children. Right? They don't want them to experience all kinds of things or see all kinds of things that could disturb them. And I think many of us live in that kind of bubble too. So he had some curiosity. What's going on outside there? And he just, you know, kind of secretly got a hold of his charioteer and asked him to take him out into the surrounding city of Kapilavastu. And what he saw kind of, you know, really confused him, so to speak. So what did he see? Well, not only did he see that the town was not this perfect little, clean little, perfect little, you know, bubble of where everybody's focused on him, but all of a sudden it's kind of chaotic out there. You know, lots of noise and lots of smells and all kinds of people and all that. But he also saw some things that really disturbed him. He saw. Supposedly, he did. He had four trips, which are very much part of. So the first trip, he saw sick people. I mean, people who didn't look good. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you know, we don't look good when we're sick, right? We kind of. Skin is pale, and there are things coming out of our nose, and we're coughing, and right, we're sick. People are diseased. People are lepers. And he asked his charioteer, "What is that? Who are those people?" "Oh, those are sick. Those are sick people, my lord." Where do they come from? You know, how'd that happen? "Oh, my lord. Everybody gets sick. That's very common. everybody who has a body is subject to sickness and disease. Now, the Buddha had only known health and well-being, and he had been so. This was the first thing, because he was totally what? Just like, you know, very much like our culture. He was totally focused on what? Identified with his body, and wanting a healthy body and a beautiful body, and all of a sudden when he looked at those people and went, you mean like that could happen to me? I could look like that? I could feel like that? I could get sick like that? And we just went through COVID, right? I mean, well, you know, it's like, what? This shouldn't be happening to us, right? I mean, even still, we kind of recoil from the idea that these things happen and they're part of life. Epidemics, pandemics, disease, sickness. So that was the first thing that disturbed him. Next voyage out, what does he see? Old people. Look around the room, you can look up here, you know, old people, right? You know, you look in the mirror, you don't look like you did when you were 20s, when you were 40, even when you're 60. You don't look like that anymore, right? Your skin, your hair, your energy, right? Aging. I mean, forgive, you know, I know it's supposed to be beautiful, but he went, it's kind of ugly compared to youth and energy and handsomeness, right? You know, when he saw people, he had that same, like, who are they? We like, where do they come from? Oh my Lord, that happens to everybody. Everybody ages, everybody looks like that. And like, you know, me? That's gonna happen to me? I'm gonna look like that? You know, and traditionally it's shown as an old person walking on a cane, all kind of bent over. Yeah, yes, my Lord, that's going to happen to you. So not only is this body, which he was totally body-centered for him, totally identified with, totally caring for all the time, it was not only going to get sick, it was going to age. So this is the second. Then the third, obviously, and if anybody has been to India, Nepal, to see dying people being carried through the streets is not unusual. I mean, this is pre-ambulances, pre-hospitals. So somebody would die and he would be carried, usually in procession, he or she, to the burning ghats or to the temples or something, for the burning or disposal in the rivers or whatever. So it was not unusual to see, so he passes these little, with the person being carried to the burning ghats, the family all crying. And he said, well, what is that? And his charioteer said, that's a dead person, my Lord. The Buddha said, where do they come from? I mean, it sounds naive, but he had never seen this, you see. Oh, sir, oh, my Lord, everybody dies. Everybody dies. That's where everybody ends up. And of course, the Buddha goes, me? I'm going to end up like that? And that was really sort of it was almost like, sickness and aging were kind of bummers, but still tolerable, because your life still continued. Your relationships continued. You could be sick and old, but you could still have all your things, you see. But death, which he realized was the end, that really got to him, because that meant that everything that he identified as himself, his body, his things, his palace, his position, his wife, his power, all of it was at the deepest level for naught. because of, you know, at a certain time, he would have to leave it all. You know, and that really got to him. You see, I mean, and we can imagine that he went into, in our own modern day, he went into kind of his own depression. We might say he got depressed when he saw that this wonderful life that he had created and lived in, and we thought, you know, it was life, was all subject to this kind of deterioration and this finality of death. You know, I'm saying depression, we don't really know. It could have been also a fear, anxiety, you know. Maybe he got angry. Nope, why didn't anybody ever tell me this, you know, kind of thing. So then he continues on, and then he has his fourth experience. His fourth experience, of course, is he sees an ascetic, a sadhu, you know, a wandering sadhu at the time in the religious tradition, which was the Vedic tradition, a mendicant. And he sees somebody, walking barefoot with just a simple robe, who looks very peaceful, very calm, you know, walking through the market or something, and he asks his charity, you know, who is that? What is that? Oh, that's a sadhu, that's a mendicant. Well, you know, what kind of work do they do? They don't do any work, sir. Where do they live? Oh, they just live wherever, sir, you know. Well, don't they have a home? No, sir, they don't have a home. They just devote themselves to, a religious life, meditative life. So this really struck him, to see somebody who had a deep calmness within them and yet had no things, right? You know, didn't have a family, didn't have money, didn't have possessions. So this really also, it made him realize, you know, there is another way. So he goes back to the palace, and he's you know, what we would call in a great spiritual crisis. You know, we talk about midlife crisis. Well, this is a big midlife crisis, and it's happening when he's 29, right? And all of a sudden, he sees the life he's leading in the palace and the life that everybody else is participating in, and which is really all based on pleasure. It's a totally pleasure-seeking life. All of a sudden, he sees it very differently. You know, it all of a sudden has lost all its attraction to him. And even the bodies, his own body, the bodies of his wife, the bodies of his courtesans, the bodies of his friends and the whole thing, all of a sudden he sees in a very different light than he had before those experiences. You know, and this culminated, you know, in him doing that which his parents had carefully crafted this life, you know, wanting him to be a certain way, had carefully crafted this life that he decided to leave that. You know, and again, I mean, there may be people listening to this call who have not done what their parents wanted them to do, who've made choices in their life that their parents were not happy about. He just had this overwhelming desire. He somehow knew that there was a way of being in this world in which suffering and loss and dissatisfaction and the whole thing he had always seen, as well as the subjectivity of dealing with sickness, old age, and death and impermanence, was something that he could realize himself. But he felt the only way he could do that, he had to leave the constraints of his life, you know, in which he was being groomed as a successor and the kingdom. And so he basically slipped away at night. And Yeah, took off his clothes, cut off his beautiful hair, and supposedly it was his charioteer that he exchanged clothes with. And he went forth into the world of southern Nepal, northern India at that time. He became what we would call today, he became a spiritual seeker. Right? And, you know, there was a spiritual religious tradition in India at that time that he was born into. It wasn't called Hinduism at that time. It was called the Vedic tradition. And I think they had the Rig Vedas and maybe the Bhagavad Gitas, you know, it had its religious. But it was also primarily, sort of again like another social condition. I talked about violence, war, and racism, casteism, and sexism. There was also a very tightly wound Brahmanic tradition in which the Brahmin priests had all the power and they had the keys to the kingdom because they were the ones who did the rituals. And so the priests, the Brahmin priests, were the intermediaries between ordinary people and the gods, right? So there was a very deeply entrenched Brahmin class. That was another part of the social reality of his time. So the Buddha went forth. He became a seeker. He went and visited and studied with for a number of years, 6 or 7 years, with all the great meditation teachers who had ashrams at that time. And, according to the history, he was, because he had such a yearning, such a thirst to really break out of his conditioning. That he, he really devoted himself very single-mindedly to mastering all these meditative traditions of his day that mostly involved experiencing deep meditative trance, right? Deep transcendental experiences. And so he mastered them all, and supposedly, all the teachers he studied with, wanted him to be their main disciple. But again, this is, listening deeply to himself. What he realized was when he was in these trance states, these meditative states, everything was perfect. He was in a state of realization. But that all these states were conditioned by the meditative experience. And so when he came out of his meditative state, he came back into the world of self, came back into the world of duality. Separation, okay? And so there was a part of him that wanted something that was constant, an experience that was not predicated on just meditative experience. And so he eventually, went on his own, really, which was a brave thing to do. Left all the ashrams he had been involved in, left his ascetic disciples, his little home team, so to speak, of 5 or 6 other buddies of his that were walking the same path, and decided this is not working. I am not. So again, it really shows that we have to have that inner knowing of what we really seek, and we can be exposed to various teachers and teachings and readings, but at the end of the day, it's up to each of us to know what is my aspiration in this life. How deep does it go? How transformative do I want to be? And the Buddha wanted the whole thing. He wanted the whole enchilada, so to speak. He wanted to be free of all suffering, all duality, separation. He wanted complete freedom. And so, you know, you follow the story, he went on his own. Luckily, he ran into a very sweet young girl who was a cowherder, who gave him offering of rice milk. So he had been practicing asceticism, so he's very weak, so he could nourish himself. Eventually, he made it to what's now called Bodh Gaya, and in India, where you can go and visit. And he just devoted himself to meditation, but his own meditation, which is just deeply, not cultivating a trance state, not cultivating just concentration. See, the practices that were prevalent then were all based on samadhi, entering these trance states, right? He cultivated insight. He looked deeply, deeply into his mind to discover what is the true nature of mind. What is the true nature of self? Is there anything there? And of course, we are told that on a certain night, and we'll talk about that more on when we celebrate the Buddha's enlightenment in December. But you know, he had a great enlightenment, a profound enlightenment. You know, where, you know, as he said, you know, the house is broken. It's hard for us to imagine that each of us are living in this conditioned world, conditioned by our backgrounds, conditioned by our society, and presently always conditioned by our thoughts, our beliefs, our attitudes. The biggest one is, you know, that I am this, and you are that, and Fred and you are two separate things, and this whole world that we've constructed around who I am and who I'm not, which is based on our beliefs and our ideas and our narratives about our past, and you know, that this whole thing that only exists in our mind, that we've constructed, is the very thing that separates us and prevents us from really touching into our true nature, our true mind. So when the Buddha had this experience, it was not only earth-shaking for him, and transforming, and incredibly blissful and free. He said, you know, all the walls have fallen down. The roof has fallen down, he said. The whole thing is just gone. And he was in bliss for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks in this great freedom, you know, this great liberation that he experienced. And again, I think it's always interesting. He reflected at the time, you know, very much like today, you know. It's like, who's going to be interested in this? You know, he looked out in the world, you know, everybody's so busy, you know, busy, 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 right? Just right? Busy, busy, busy. They got their work to do. They, you know, they got their gains to do. They got all their, you know, all their activities to do. And, you know, they're just busy, 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 right? And they're, you know, working at this and volunteering here and doing this. You know, who really wants freedom to be free? Who's going to be interested in this? You know, and endlessly seeking pleasures and gain, and you know, I mean, people, right? Like us. And so he kind of thought, nobody's going to be interested in this. You know, nobody's going to be interested in following a path that leads to freedom. But luckily, he, you know, in some cases it was Brahma or Shaka, what Sakya, Saka, one of the Buddhist gods. Came down to him, and in the case, it was some Burmese traveling businessman who came to him and convinced him that there are people out there where the dust of worldliness is not heavy on their eyes. It's a beautiful metaphor. It does not lie heavy on their eyes. Many people, it's heavy. You know, their worldliness is just heavy on their eyes. They can't see outside it. But he said there are those out there where it's just very light. And so, you know, so they would be open. They would be interested in what you have to share and tell them. So so basically, you know, that was the next 50 years that the Buddha taught very widely, gathered many disciples, created the monastic institution. I was going to say, just very quickly, but we have kids here today. So how did he deal with the incipient casteism and racism of his society? Well, in his community, there was no distinction. There was no caste distinction. You could have come from any of the four classes in his community. Everybody was equal. There was no caste. So he created a community that lived without the that way. He over time created an order of nuns, which was very radical at that time, because again, women were under the care always of their families. The idea that they would have their own community, right? Self-governing was a very radical, right? Basically, he created a community of simplicity. The community at that time would have no possessions. They would have a couple of robes. They would have their pots. And they would beg. So he created a community in which the exchange with the lay community would always be, the lay community would support them because they would give the teachings, but they themselves were wanderers. It was only over time that actually kind of monastic communities were created. In the early days, they didn't even have that. So it's kind of a scary thing, isn't it? Just to be totally dependent on others. But he felt, his community would be people who would practice deeply, and by able to be an example and being able to share the Dharma with all kinds of people doing all kinds of things, that the lay community would support them. There were numerous examples of him of dealing with kings and wars, and doing his best to bring reconciliation between the sides to minimize the violence and the conflict. So again, his answers were really very much like Thich Nhat Hanh's answers, which is he created a community of resistance, we might say. Community of in his monastic community, where people lived, they didn't wait for society to change. They created a community in which people and the values, of awakening, of an awakened life, were manifest. Traditionally, that monastic community has been an example to all of us, that one can live very simply, and that one can live in community with people without distinctions, right? That the rest of society, in its ignorance, uphold. So, and I think that really speaks to today. So the birth of the Buddha, for each of us, can have its own meaning, but at its deepest level, we are just like him. We are human beings, living our life the way we've been conditioned, right? By our families, by our society, by our experiences, and we are going along in our life, seeking gain, seeking advancement, seeking security, seeking pleasure, thinking all the things that we are seeking in life. And yet, And yet, not only because of sickness, old age, and death, but also because of some fundamental unsatisfactoriness of living that kind of life in a sense of separation from each other, from nature, etc. There are many of us who may think, maybe there's a better way to live life. You know, that the worldly life does not give me the inner peace, the open-heartedness, the real capacity to love all beings, to be compassionate and caring for all beings, to really want to alleviate the suffering of all beings, and to be very free and open and simple in life, free of all our emotional sufferings and all our neuroses and all our depressions and anxieties and you know all that stuff, which we just kind of accept as being normal. You know, maybe there is another way. And that is really the great, that is really the message of the Buddha's birth, that we all, each of us, have a baby Buddha inside us. Right? That's waiting to be discovered. That's waiting to be born. And we are, I mean, the Dharma, the Dharmic institutions, the teachers, you know, they can nurture us and support us. But each of us have to be the midwife of our own, of the birth of our own baby Buddha. You know? No one else is going to do it for us. So today is the Buddha's birthday. The kids will be coming in shortly. Traditionally, and we'll be doing that outside. It's called bathing the baby Buddha. So when we go out in the garden, you'll see we have set up on a table. There's a large bowl that has kind of sweet tea in it. And in the middle of it is the there's a statue of the baby Buddha. Looks like a young kid with his, and he's like this, because supposedly he when he came out of his mother's womb. Oh, and by the way, I didn't want to tell you this, but his mother, Queen Maya, she died 7 days after his birth. Do you know why? Because this is what all mothers of Buddhas, they all die, because it would break their heart. You see, to have their child, you know, go off and leave everything. So traditionally, the mothers of Buddhas get this kind of shortcut, where they die in 7 days and then they go off to a heaven or something where they can kind of hang out in a good space and never have to experience the loss of their child. So we will go out there and we'll bathe the Buddha. And again, because traditionally one of the things that in the Vedic tradition they would do when they came to the temple and the gods and everything, they would do what? Bathe them, pour water, pour scented water over them. It's kind of a way of honoring. So we'll go out and we'll just pour some, and then afterwards there'll be refreshments. We invite everybody to join us for refreshments, and I believe, and there's some games. And there'll be a piñata for the kids, and I believe there's a birthday cake. Does it say "Happy Birthday, Siddhartha"? I don't know what it. So I think the kids are here. So thank you. That's today is the birth of the Buddha.